honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, honoring two men this week who just celebrated their 101st birthdays. Both experienced the first day of American combat in World War II, albeit in two very different places. If you ever pass through Las Cruces, New Mexico, the Bataan Death March Memorial there is one of the most moving memorials I've ever seen. There were more men from New Mexico on the death march than from any other state. Bataan Memorial Park in Albuquerque is also worth your time, and Bill Overmeyer knows both of those spots very well. He also knows that he easily could have ended up on that infamous march that claimed thousands of lives.
The day before Bataan fell, I was walking someplace in the banana grove with a friend of mine from here. We looked up. Gosh, there's a plane. Well, he's got his motor off. He's coasting down. And I could have thrown a rock at him. If I'd had my rifle, I could have shot him and got him. My rifle was back where I left. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you shouldn't do that. You should never lose your rifle. And my buddy, he'd done the same thing. So this plane dropped a bomb, and we hit the ground, and the bomb went off on the other side of my friend. And he got a terrible shrapnel in his leg. They hauled him off to the hospital. He had malaria already. He never made it. Mm-hmm. His dad was a dentist here in Albuquerque.
You mentioned Bataan falling, and I've heard a lot of stories of the lead-up to that from different survivors that I've talked to, where they mentioned things like you said, that provisions were World War I era defenses, guns. They were low on ammunition. And then the food supply, there was a shortage of food, didn't have a whole lot to eat. Were you guys starting to experience some of that?
Yes, we were. We were down to half rations, and then they got us down to quarter rations. We had a crew out that would go for game. First, we ate carabao. It was a form of steak. We ate horse meat. The Philippine scouts were a cavalry unit before we ever got there. Well, we got to eat their horses.
Wow. Well, desperate times, desperate measures.
I ate monkey meat. Mm-hmm. I ate iguana. Anyway, we were eating monkey meat, and rice ration was down to something like a quarter of a pound per day or something like that. And we started losing weight. And we got to Bataan. We were set up in a banana grove, and we used to eat the bananas. They were about 4 inches long, mm-hmm. and they were sweeter than pineapple. Boy, they were good. But I've never eaten an American banana because they're nothing like those.
Can't compare to those ones all those years ago, huh?
No way.
Had you heard at this point, as Bataan's about to fall, you're realizing you're in another desperate situation, did you guys hear at the time what MacArthur had done and where he had gone? Were you guys aware of it, or did that not come till later?
We knew it day by day, everything. Yeah. We had fondness for Wainwright. He would go up the front lines. He would leave the tunnel in Corregidor and go up and check the units and so forth and so on. And he was more or less in charge of the whole thing. And MacArthur was holed up in the Malinta Tunnel. He never peeped out. We call him Dugout Doug. As mm-hmm. Everybody gets nicknames. Anyway, we heard about him getting a call from Washington and having to go to Australia. I don't feel bad about it. I think it was a wise decision, and the system that they used to retake the Philippines and all of the islands in that area were, I think they were the right ones.
Well, and maybe the lens of history has helped you understand that his strategic importance and what ended up happening, it was important for him to be saved. But at the time, I'm sure there was some grumbling among the troops that, here, your leader in this area of the war is bailing out on you.
That's right. Well, we just lived from day to day, mainly just standing there waiting for action. It was boring. Really, it was boring. Months after months of just waiting for action. Right after that that bomber, drive bomber, dropped that bomb and ruined us, one of our guys. The next day, Bataan surrendered. Well, before that happened, the night before, it was still daylight, and Jack Ellis, who was the commander, he was a first lieutenant, and our captain had been wounded that day. Jack Ellis was a personal friend of mine, and he said, "Bill, go down to headquarters, down the trail, and find out what to do. Our communications are out, our telephones are out, we've been bombed, and they were destroyed, and we don't know what to do." And so I picked up two other guys. One of them was the son of the principal of Albuquerque High School. So we went down this dark trail. We had our guns with us. And about real dark, well, we got down to headquarters, and they were all loading up in trucks and command cars and heading south for the bottom end of Bataan. And I asked, he was a colonel. I said, "What are we supposed to do? Battery B." He said, "Hell, I don't know what to tell you to do. Use your own damn judgment." So I'd walked all that distance and gotten a negative answer. And so I had to turn around and go right back up the trail. And it turned dark by that time. And shells were coming over from Corregidor. Shells were coming overhead from the Japanese. And they were bombing Corregidor, shelling Corregidor. And we got back up to the battery midnight. The moon was out, bright as day, and we could look over in the bushes over there, and we could just imagine the Japs are over there. And we checked the guns, and the M4 director, the height finder, and everything had been ruined, scuttled, damaged, ruined. The Japs couldn't use it. So we turned around and went right back down the trail. We got down almost to the water's edge and laid down on the ground to take a break. It's daylight. The ground started to shake. Earthquake.
Wow.
The land had the same reception as we had. Negative. We got up and kept walking. And myself and one other guy, one of them that took off and went someplace else. We got down to the water's edge, and there was a boat out there just aimed towards Corregidor. And it had about 30 guys on the deck. It was a flat-top motor launch is what it was. And so we waded out and got on the boat. And the boat took off. We got about halfway over to Corregidor. Uh-oh, here comes three dive bombers looking for trouble. And we were trouble. So we took our guns and aimed. And somebody on our boat said, "Put your damn guns down." As if we didn't aim our guns, they wouldn't aim their guns. Well, somebody's kind of foolish. Not very good leadership. So we put our guns down. And I figured, well, I'm right on the stern. And they're going to come. And here came one plane, peeled off, and came down at us. I thought, well, is he going to drop a bomb? Or is he going to shoot us with a machine gun? If it's a bomb, it's going to get us. If it's a machine gun, well, maybe if I jump in the water and get it deep as I could get, those bullets won't reach me. So that's what I was going to do.
Mm-hmm.
So here come the plane, and here come the machine guns. We looked up. Oh, he's not shooting. What's happening? Oh, a PT boat right over there. Had twin 50 caliber guns on the front and twin 50s on the back, and he was shooting at that plane, and that plane chickened out, pulled away, and left us alone. Mm. We got all the way to Corregidor without getting killed.
PT boat saved you.
Saved my life. You bet it did.
Well, and your decision to get on that boat maybe saved your life. Is that a stretch, or am I correct in thinking that if you guys had not found that boat and had been stuck on Bataan, that you would have been swept up in the death march yourself?
Exactly. Of course, we didn't know anything about the death march at that time, but that's exactly what happened. Everybody that was on Bataan that surrendered made the death march. I got to Corregidor, but I was only there for a day or so. Mm-hmm. And I walked through Malinta Tunnel, and I saw Wainwright and how terrible he looked with all the pressure and the war and so forth. They sent us over that night to Fort Hughes, which was another mile or two off of the tip of Corregidor. Fort Hughes was another fortified island with 12-inch mortars. And those 12-inch mortars were all facing Manila Bay. And they had been put in and developed right after the Spanish-American War to keep any of the Spanish-American or any other country from bringing in ships to capture Manila.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically all there was on the island that I knew of. They had tunnels that were manufactured out of the rock formations. They had the ammunition in the tunnels, and we ate and we slept in the tunnels, and we existed in the tunnels most of the time. Anyway, this one day we were out on the beach, my buddy and I, Eastern Beach, and here came a formation of Japanese ships. Heavy bombers, they were flying high because they had learned that if they flew at a certain elevation that the 3-inch guns could not reach them. It was due to the fact that we had World War I fuses in our ammunition called powder train fuses. It's the same thing they use for blowing up dynamite.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just could not do the job. But anyway, we looked up, saw the planes, and we said, well, they're coming over. They're not going to bomb us. They're going to bomb Corregidor, which is just a couple miles up. After a few minutes, well, they were closer, and bombs had not dropped yet. But I decided, well, you know, why don't we just play safe? And there's a box in the sand that's a little concrete box. I'd never seen one like that. I didn't know what it was for. There was no wiring in it or anything else, but it was big enough for two guys to get in. We got in them, and guess what? A bomb hit within 15 feet of that box. It was probably a 500-pounder, and it blew a hole in the sand as deep as a man standing in the bottom and holding his hand up, and his hand would be even with the ground level.
That's a big crater.
It saved our lives.
Well, there are a few of those moments in your story. We've heard a couple of them already, and there's another. As the days went by, and obviously that's a close call that gets your attention, but were you starting to wonder when, not if, you'd be captured? Or tell me how that all unfolded when you finally realized that your future was going to be pretty uncertain as a prisoner of the Japanese.
We saw the day that Corregidor surrendered, they had the white flag up. And we said, uh-oh, we're going to get it. And they'll probably come over tonight. And sure enough, they did. The Japanese sent a boat over. One of our majors went out and met them and talked to them and surrendered Fort Hughes as well. And we were captives. We were in the tunnel, one of the tunnels, when the Japanese came in at night. We didn't know whether we were going to get killed, massacred, or just what. We were standing along one side of the little tunnel, and they walked in. One guy was carrying a machine gun, and another one was carrying ammunition. And they came in, and we did what they told us to do. And the next day, well, we were looking for food, looking for water, and we ended up, we were taken over back to Corregidor to a place called 92nd Garage. And we were there for about 13 days until the Japs got a ship ready. They took us over to Manila, then they paraded us down the main street of Manila and bragging about how good soldiers they were and so on and so forth. And we went along with it. You bet we did. We didn't stick our necks out or do anything we shouldn't do. We ended up at the main hospital there in Manila.
Bill Overmeyer would spend the next 3 years as a prisoner of war.
We worked 9 days and got the 10th day off. Now, fleas and lice were rampant. You cannot believe going through life with insects crawling inside your clothes. We spent the day off, taking our clothes off, turning them inside out, finding the lice. They didn't jump, but we could catch them and pop them between our thumbnails. Well, later on, it turned into fleas. We'd find a flea, And about the time we'd start to pop him, he'd jump. We'd never catch him. Mm-hmm. But we slept on a straw mat. It was raised up off of the floor. And that's where they came from, I guess. We didn't know where they were. The food was bad, bad, bad. I got down to 60 kilos or even less, which is 132 pounds. But we had many diseases. Beriberi was one of them. Pellagra was another. And a lot of guys had malaria. And it was just unbelievable. Boy, we'd eat anything we could get. Anything. There were no dogs. There were no cats. There was no anything around that was edible. We ate it.
How was it that you were liberated? And what was that glorious day like for you?
Well, one day after work, the commandant, he spoke a little English.
Uh-huh.
And we went into the mess hall, just the officers and the non-commissioned officers. And he got up in front, he said, "Peace is smiling." We said, "What'd you say?" "Peace is smiling, goo. The war is over, goo." Hallelujah. That place went up in smoke. He said, "Don't tell the men. Keep it quiet, please." We said, "Yes, we will." Until we got out the door. And we told everybody else as quick as we could.
How do you keep that news to yourself, right? What is it that you want to keep alive? What's the history that you think your kids and grandkids and great-grandkids need to remember? What makes that so important?
When I was at UNM in the National Guard and we went down to Fort Bliss, I looked one day at how many guys came from the University of New Mexico. And I've made some ridiculous statements, I think. I think half of the male population of the University of New Mexico was in the National Guard. And all of them were down there at Fort Bliss with me. Well, I know that hell ships killed a tremendous number of them. The Death March killed a bunch more. But to think that I firmly believe that less than half of our boys came home. In other words, we had a nominal 2,000 personnel. Half of that is 1,000 men. I believe there are anywhere from 900 to 1,100 of us died overseas. And that's a pretty big sacrifice. That's a pretty damn big mistake for the politicians in Washington, D.C. to allow a country get in such a bad state and the relationship with that country get so bad that they send us out on the spear of the sword and then take the sword away from us. It's ridiculous.
Well, and if you don't learn from history, you're bound to repeat it, right?
That's right. That's exactly right. That's exactly what it's all about.
Is there anything else that I haven't asked you about that you think it's important for us to know?
I can't think of anything at the moment. I appreciate the privilege of being able to do this. I'm sure the guys that I know, personal friends, my closest friends, that didn't come back, I'm sure they'd be grateful too. And that's the reason I do it.
To honor them.
Amen. Amen.
Bill Overmyer and Frank Paredes, two men who endured so much in World War II from start to finish. You can link to their complete original interviews and find photos of them at hometownheroesradio.com. That's all the time we have for this episode, but I hope you can join us again next time when we celebrate Black History Month with men who served in a segregated military in World War II. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.